it remained fixated on the ugly illithids. "Would I have gone to all the trouble of learning to cast from a different perspective?" Harkle answered, seeming wounded by her doubts.
"Of course," Bella replied. "Well, those dwarves do need our help."
"Indeed." A quick chant by the daughter of Delroy brought a shimmering blue, door-shaped field right before the two wizards.
"After you,"
Bella said politely. "Oh, rank before beauty," Harkle answered, waving his hand toward the door, indicating that Bella should lead.
"No time for wasting,"
came a clear voice behind them, and surprisingly strong hands pressed against both Bella and Harkle's hips, heaving them both for the door. They went through together, and Fret, the tidy dwarf, pushed in right behind them. The second door appeared on the floor between the illithids and their stunned dwarven prey, and out popped the three-dimensional travelers. Fret skidded to the side, trying to round up the vulnerable dwarves, while Harkle and Belladon Delroy mustered their nerve and faced the octopus-headed creatures.
"I understand your anger," Harkle began.
And he and his companion shuddered as a wave of mental energy rolled across their chests and shoulders and heads, leaving a wake of tingles.
"If I were as ugly as you,"
Harkle continued, and a second wave came through.
"I would be mean, too,"
Harkle finished, and a third blast of energy came forth, followed closely by the illithids. Bella screamed, and Harkle nearly fainted as the monstrous things pushed in close, tentacles latching onto cheeks and chins. One went straight up Harkle's nose, in search of brain matter to devour.
"You are sure?"
Bella cried out. But Harkle, deep in the throes of his latest spell, didn't hear her. He didn't struggle against the illithid, for he didn't want the thing to jostle him too severely. It was hard enough to concentrate with wriggling tentacles burrowing under the skin of his face. Those tentacles swelled now, extracting their prize. An unmistakably sour look crossed the normally expressionless features of both the creatures. Harkle's hands came up slowly, palms down, his thumbs touching and his other fingers spread wide. A flash of fire erupted from his hands, searing the confused illithid, burning its robes. It tried to pull away, and Harkle's facial skin bulged weirdly as the tentacles began to slide free. Harkle was already moving with his next spell. He reached into his robes and extracted a dart, a leaf that had been mushed to powder, and a stringy, slimy thing, a snake's intestine, and squashed them all together as he completed the chant. From that hand came forth a small bolt, shooting across the 2 feet to stick into the still-burning illithid's belly. The creature gurgled something indecipherable and finally fell away, stumbling, grasping at its newest wound. For while the fires still nipped at it in places, this newest attack hurt more. The enchanted bolt pumped acid into its victim. Down went the illithid, still clutching at the leaking bolt. It had underestimated its enemy, and it telepathically sent that very message to its immediate companion, who already understood their error, and to Methil, deep in the caverns beside Matron Bayenry. Bella couldn't concentrate. Though her spell of polymorph had been perfect, her brain safely tucked away where the illithid could not find it, she simply couldn't concentrate with the squiggly tentacles probing around her skull. She berated herself, told herself that the daughter of Delroy should be in more control. She heard a rumbling sound, a cart rolling near, and opened her eyes to see Fret push the cart right up behind the illithid, a host of drow in pursuit. Holding his nerve, the tidy dwarf leaped atop the cart and drew out a tiny silver hammer.
"Let her go!"
Fret cried, bringing the nasty little weapon to bear. To the dwarf's surprise and disgust, his hammer sank into the engaged illithid's bulbous head and ichor spewed forth, spraying the dwarf and staining his white robes. Fret knew the drow were bearing down on him. He had resolved to make one attack on the illithid, then turn in defense against the dark elves. But all plans flew away in the face of that gory mess, the one thing that could bring the tidy dwarf into full battle rage. No woodpecker ever hit a log as rapidly. Fret's hammer worked so as to seem a blur, and each hit sent more of the illithid's brain matter spraying, which only heightened the tidy dwarf's frenzy. Still, that would have been the end of Fret, of all of them, had not Harkle quickly enacted his next spell. He focused on the area in front of the charging drow, threw a bit of lard into the air, and called out his next Dwiamer. The floor became slick with grease, and the charge came to a stumbling, tumbling end. Its head smashed to dripping pulp, the illithid slumped before Bella, the still-clinging tentacles bringing her low as well. She grabbed frantically at those tentacles and yanked them free, then stood straight and shuddered with pure revulsion. "I told you that was the way to fight mind flayers," Harkle said happily, for it had been his plan every step of the way. "Shut up," Bella said to him, her stomach churning. She looked all around, seeing enemies closing in from many directions.
"And get us out of here," she said.
Harkle looked at her, confused and a bit wounded by her disdain. The plan had worked, after all. A moment later, Harkle too became more than a little frightened, as he came to realize that he had forgotten that last little detail and had no spells left that would transport them back to the higher tiers. He stammered, trying to find the words to best explain their dilemma. Relieved he was, and Bella too, when the dwarven wedge reformed around them, Fret joining the ranks.
"We'll get ye back up,"
the leader of the grateful dwarves promised. And on they rolled, once more burying everything in their path. Even more destructive now was their march, for every so often a blast of lightning or a line of searing fire shot out from their ranks as Harkle and Bella joined in the fun. Still, Bella remained uncomfortable and wanted this all to end so that she could return to her normal physiology. Harkle had studied illithids intently and knew as much about them as perhaps any wizard in all the realms. Their mentally debilitating blasts were conical, he had assured her, and so, if he and she could get close, only the top half of their bodies would be affected. Thus they had enacted the physical transformation enchantment, wherein Harkle and Bella appeared the same, yet had transfigured two areas of their makeup, their brains and their buttocks. Harkle smiled at his cleverness as the wedge rolled on. Such a transformation had been a delicate thing, requiring many hours of study and preparation. But it had been worth the trouble every second, the Harple believed, recalling the sour looks on the ugly, illithid faces. The rumbles from the collapse of the bridges and of all the antechambers near Garam's Gorge were felt in the lowest tunnels of Mithril Hall, even beyond, in the upper passages of the wild Underdark itself. How much work Brunner's people would have if ever they tried to open the eastern door again. But the drow advance had been stopped and was well worth the price, for now General Dagna and his force of defenders were free to go. But where? The tough, battle-hardened dwarf wondered. Reports came to him that the Undercity was under full attack, but he also realized that the western door, near Keeper's Dale, was vulnerable, with only a few hundred dwarves guarding the many winding tunnels, and with no provisions for such catastrophic measures as had been taken here in the east. The tunnels in the west could not be completely dropped. There had not been time to rig them so. Dagna looked around at his thousand troops, many of them wounded, but all of them eager for more battle, eager to defend their sacred homeland.
"The Undercity," the general announced a moment later.
If the western door was breached, the invaders would have to find their way through. No easy task, considering the myriad choices they would face. The fighting had already come to the Undercity, so that was where Dagna belonged. Normally, it would have taken many minutes, a half hour or more, for the dwarves to get down to the fighting, even if they went the whole way at a full charge. But this, too, had been foreseen, so Dagna led his charges to the appointed spot, new doors that had been cut into the walls connecting to chimneys running up from the great furnaces. As soon as those doors were opened, Dagna and his soldiers heard the battle, so they went without delay, one after another, onto the heavy ropes that had been set in place. Down they slid, fearlessly, singing songs to Clangadin. Down they went, hitting the floor at a full run, rushing out of the warm furnaces and right into the fray, streaming endlessly, it seemed, as were the drow coming in from the lower tunnels. The fighting in the Undercity grew ever furious. Chapter 25 Keeper's Dale. Brigignon's force swept into Keeper's Dale, the sticky-footed lizards making trails where none could be found.
They came down the northern wall like a sheet of water, into the misty valley, ominous shadows slipping past tall pillars of stone. Though it was warmer here than on the open northern face, the drow were uncomfortable. There were no formations like this in the Underdark, no misty valleys, except those filled with the toxic fumes of unseen volcanoes. Scouting reports had been complete, though, and had specifically outlined this very spot, the doorstep of Mithril Hall's western door, as safe for passage. Thus the Bayenri Lizard Riders went into the valley without question, fearing their own volatile matron mother more than any possible toxic fumes. As they entered the vale, they heard the fighting on the southern side of the mountain. Brigignon nodded when he took the moment to notice that the battle was coming closer. All was going as planned. The enemy was in retreat, no doubt, being herded like stupid Rothe into the valley, where the slaughter would begin in full. The moving shadows that were Brigignon's force slipped quietly through the mist, past the stone sentinels, trying to get a lay of the valley, trying to find the optimum ambush areas. Above the mist, a line of fire broke the general darkness of the night sky, streaking fast and angling into the vale. Brigignon watched it, as did so many, not knowing what it might be. As she crossed above the force, Alustriel loosed the last barrage of her magic, a blast of lightning, a rain of greenish pulses of searing energy, and a shower of explosive fireballs that liquefied stone. The alert dark elves responded before the chariot crossed over the northern lip of the vale, hit back with enchanted crossbow quarrels and similar spells of destruction. The flames of the chariot flared wider, caught in the midst of a fireball, and the whole of the cart jerked violently to the side as a line of lightning blasted against its base. Alustriel's magic had killed more than a few and taken the mounts out from under many others, but the real purpose in the wizard's passing had been the part of decoy, for every drow was turned heavenward when the second battalion of the Knights in Silver joined the fray, charging through Keepersdale, horseshoes clacking deafeningly on the hard stone. Lances lowered, the knights barreled through the initial ranks of drow, running them down with their larger mounts. But these were Bienri Lizard Riders, the most elite force in all of Menzo Baranzon, a complement of warriors and wizards that did not know fear. Silent commands went out from Brigignon, passed from waggling fingers to waggling fingers. Even after the surprise barrage from the sky, and the sudden charge of the force that the drow did not know were in Keepersdale, the dark elf ranks outnumbered the knights in silver by more than 3-1. Had those odds been 1-1, the knights in silver still would have had no chance. The tide turned quickly, with the knights, those who were not taken down, inevitably falling back and regrouping into tight formations. Only the mist and the unfamiliar terrain prevented the slaughter from being wholesale. Only the fact that the overwhelming drow force could not find all the targets allowed the valiant knights to continue to resist. Near the rear of the dark elf ranks, Brigignon heard the commotion as one unfortunate human got separated and confused, galloping his mount unintentionally toward the north, away from his comrades. The Bayenri's son signaled for his personal guards to follow him, but to stay behind, and took up the chase, his great lizard slinking and angling to intercept. He saw the shadowy figure, and what a magnificent thing Brigignon thought the rider to be, so high and tall on his powerful steed. That image did not deter the weapons master of Menzo Baranzon's first house. He came around a pillar of stone, just to the side of the knight, and called out to the man. The great horse skidded and stopped, the knight wheeling it around to face Brigignon. He said something Brigignon could not understand, some proclamation of defiance, no doubt, then lowered his long lance and kicked his horse into a charge. Brigignon leveled his own mottled lance and drove his heels into the lizard's flanks, prodding the beast on. He couldn't match the speed of the knight's horse, but the horse couldn't match the lizard's agility. As the opponents neared, Brigignon swerved aside, brought his lizard right up the side of a thick stone pillar. The knight, surprised by the quickness of the evasion, couldn't bring his lance out fast enough for an effective strike, but as the two passed, Brigignon managed to prod the running horse in the flank. It wasn't a severe hit, barely a scratch, but this was no ordinary lance.
The 10-foot pole that Bourguignon carried was a devilish death lance, among the most cunning and wicked of drow weapons. As the lance tip connected on the horse flesh, cutting through the metal armor the beast wore as though it were mere cloth, dark, writhing tentacles of black light crawled down its length. The horse whinnied pitifully, kicked and jumped, and came to a skidding stop. Somehow the knight managed to hold his seat. "Run on!" he cried to his shivering mount, not understanding. "Run on!" The knight suddenly felt as though the horse was somehow less substantial beneath him, felt the beast's ribs against his calves. The horse threw its head back and whinnied again, an unearthly, undead cry, and the knight blanched when he looked into the thing's eyes, orbs that burned red with some evil enchantment. The death lance had stolen the creature's life force, had turned the proud, strong stallion into a gaunt, skeletal thing, an undead, evil thing. Thinking quickly, the knight dropped his lance, drew his huge sword, and sheared off the monster's head with a single swipe. He rolled aside as the horse collapsed beneath him and came to his feet, hopping around in confusion. Dark shapes encircled him, and he heard the hiss of nearby lizards, sucking sounds as sticky feet came free of stone. Bourguignon Bayenry approached slowly. He too lowered his lance. A flick of his wrist freed him from his binding saddle, and he slid off his mount, determined to test one of these surface men in single combat, determined to show these drow nearby the skill of their leader. Out came the weapons master's twin swords, sharp and enchanted, among the very finest of drow weapons. The knight, nearly a foot taller than this adversary, but knowing the reputation of dark elves, was rightfully afraid. He swallowed that fear, though, and met Bourguignon head-on, sword against sword. The knight was good, had trained hard for all of his adult life, but if he trained for all of his remaining years as well, they would not total the decades the longer living Bourguignon had spent with the sword. The knight was good. He lived for almost 5 minutes. Alustriel felt the chill, moist air of a low cloud brush her face, and it brought her back to consciousness. She moved quickly, trying to right the chariot, and felt the bite of pain all along her side. She had been hit by spell and by weapon, and her burned and torn robes were wet with her own blood. What would the world think if she, the Lady of Silvery Moon, died here, she wondered. To her haughty colleagues, this was a minor war, a battle that had no real bearing on the events of the world, a battle in their eyes that Alustriel of Silvery Moon should have avoided. Alustriel brushed her long silvery hair, hair that was also matted with blood, back from her beautiful face. Anger welled within her as she thought of the arguments she had fought over King Brunner's request for aid. Not a single advisor or counselor in Silvery Moon, with the exception of Fret, wanted to answer that call, and Alustriel had to wage a long, tiresome battle of words to get even the 200 knights in silver released to Mithril Hall. What was happening to her own city, the lady wondered now, floating high above the disaster of Fourth Peak. Silvery Moon had earned a reputation as the most generous of places, as a defender of the oppressed, champion of goodness. The knights had gone off to war eagerly, but they weren't the problem, and had never been. The problem, the wounded Alustriel came to realize, was the comfortably entrenched bureaucratic class, the political leaders who had become too secure in the quality of their own lives. That seemed crystal clear to Alustriel now, wounded and fighting hard to control her enchanted chariot in the cold night sky above the battle. She knew the heart of Brunner and his people. She knew the goodness of Drizzt and the value of the hearty men of Settlestone. They were worth defending, Alustriel believed. Even if all of Silvery Moon were consumed in the war, these people were worth defending because in the end, in the annals future historians would pen, that would be the measure of Silvery Moon. That generosity would be the greatness of the place, would be what set Silvery Moon apart from so many other petty kingdoms. But what was happening to her city? Alustriel wondered, and she came to understand the cancer that was growing amidst her own ranks. She would go back to Silvery Moon and purge that disease, she determined. But not now. Now she needed rest. She had done her part, to the best of her abilities, and perhaps at the price of her own life, she realized, as another pain shot through her wounded side. Her colleagues would lament her death, would call it a waste, considering the minor scale of this war for Mithril Hall. Alustriel knew better, knew how she, like her city, would be ultimately judged. She managed to bring the chariot crashing down to a wide ledge, and she tumbled out as the fiery Dwyamer dissipated into nothingness. The Lady of Silvery Moon sat there against the stone, in the cold, looking down on the distant scramble far below her. She was out of the fight, but she had done her part. She knew she could die with no guilt weighing on her heart. Bourguignon Bayenry rode through the ranks of lizard-mounted drow, holding high his twin blood-stained swords. The dark elves rallied behind their leader, filtered from obelisk to obelisk, cutting the battlefield in half and more. The mobility and speed of the larger horses favored the knights, but the dark elves' cunning tactics were quick to steal that advantage. To their credit, the knights were killing drow at a ratio of 1-1, a remarkable feat considering the larger drow numbers and the skill of their enemies. Even so, the ranks of knights were being diminished. Hope came in the form of a fat wizard riding a half-horse, half-frog beastie, and leading the remnants of the defenders of the southern face, hundreds of men riding and running, from battle and into battle. Bourguignon's force was fast pushed across the breadth of Keeper's Dale, back toward the northern wall, and the defending knights rode free once more. But in came the pursuit from the south, the vast force of drow and humanoid monsters. In came those dark elf wizards, who had survived Alustriel's conflagration in the thick copse. The ranks of the defenders quickly sorted out, with Berkthgar's hearty warriors rallying behind their mighty leader, and Besnel's knights linking with the force that had stood firm in Keeper's Dale. Likewise did the Long Riders fall into line behind Regveld, and the riders of Nesme, both of the survivors, joined their brethren from the west. Magic flashed, and metal clanged, and man and beast screamed in agony. The mist thickened with sweat, and the stone floor of the valley darkened with blood. The defenders would have liked to form a solid line of defense, but to do so would leave them terribly vulnerable to the wizards, so they had followed savage Berkthgar's lead, had plunged into the enemy force headlong, accepting the sheer chaos. Bourguignon ran his mount halfway up the northern wall, high above the valley, to survey the glorious carnage. The weapons master cared nothing for his dead comrades, including many dark elves whose broken bodies littered the valley floor. This fight would be won easily, Bourguignon thought, and the western door to Mithril Hall would be his. All glory for House Bayenry. When Stumpet Rakingclaw came up from the Undercity to Mithril Hall's western door, she was dismayed. Not by the reports of the vicious fighting out in Keeper's Dale, but by the fact that the dwarven guards had not gone out to aid the valiant defenders. Their orders had been explicit. They were to remain inside the complex to defend the tighter tunnels, and if the secret door was found by the enemy and the defenders were pushed back, the dwarves were prepared to drop those tunnels near the door. Those orders, given by General Dagna, Brunner's second in command, had not foreseen the Battle of Keeper's Dale. Brunner had appointed Stumpet as High Cleric of Mithril Hall, and had done so publicly and with much fanfare, so that there would be no confusion concerning rank once battle was joined. That decision, that public ceremony, gave Stumpet the power she needed now, allowed her to change the orders, and the 500 dwarves assigned to guard the western door, who had watched with horror the carnage from afar, were all too happy to hear the new command. There came a rumbling beneath the ground in all of Keeper's Dale, the grating of stone against stone. On the northern side of the valley, Bourguignon held tight to his sticky-footed mount and hoped the thing wouldn't be shaken from the wall. He listened closely to the echoes, discerning the pattern, then looked to the southeastern corner of the valley. A glorious, stinging light flashed there as the western door of Mithril Hall slid open. Bourguignon's heart skipped a beat. The dwarves had opened the way. Out they came, hundreds of bearded folk, rushing to their allies' aid, singing and banging their axes and hammers against their shining shields, pouring from the door that was secret no more. They came up to and beyond Berkthgar's line, their tight battle groups slicing holes in the ranks of goblin and kobold and drow alike, pushing deeper into the throng. "Fools," the Beanri weapons master whispered, "for even if 1,000 or 2,000 dwarves came into Keeper's Dale, the course of the battle would not be changed. They had come out because their morals demanded it, Bergignon knew. They had opened their door and abandoned their best defenses because their ears could not tolerate the screams of men dying in their defense. How weak these surface dwellers were, the sinister drow thought. For in Menzo Berenzon, courage and compassion were never confused. The furious dwarves came into the battle hard, driving through drow and goblins with abandon. Stumpet Rakingclaw, fresh from her exploits in the Undercity, led their charge. She was out of light pellets, but called to her god now, enacting enchantments to brighten Keeper's Dale. The dark elves quickly countered every spell, as the dwarf expected, but Stumpet figured that every drow concentrating on a globe of darkness was out of the fight, at least momentarily. The magic of Moradin, Dumathoin, and Clangadin flowed freely through the priestess. She felt as though she was a pure conduit, the connection to the surface for the dwarven gods. The dwarves rallied around her loud prayers as she screamed to her gods with all her heart. Other defenders rallied around the dwarves, and suddenly they were gaining back lost ground. Suddenly, the idea of a single line of defense was not so ridiculous. High on the wall across the way, Bergignon chuckled at the futility of it all. This was a temporary surge, he knew, and the defenders of the western door had come together in one final, futile push. All the defense and all the defenders, and Bergignon's force still outnumbered them several times over. The weapons master coaxed his mount back down the wall, gathered his elite troops around him, and determined how to turn back the momentum. When Keeper's Dale fell, so would the western door. And Keeper's Dale would fall, Bergignon assured his companions with all confidence, within the hour. Chapter 26. Snarl against snarl. The main corridors leading to the lower door of Mithril Hall had been dropped and sealed, but that had been expected by the invading army. Even with the largest concentration of drow slowed to a crawl out in the tunnels beyond the door, the dwarven complex was hard-pressed. And though no reports had come to Yutha Gentol about the fighting outside the mountain, the mighty weapons master could well imagine the carnage on the slopes, with dwarves and weakling humans dying by the score. Both doors of Mithril Hall were likely breached by now, Yutha Gentol believed, with Bergignon's lizard riders flooding the higher tunnels. That notion bothered the weapons master of Barrison del Armgo more than a little. If Bergignon was in Mithril Hall and Drisdo Erden was there, the renegade might fall to the son of House Beanri. Thus, Yutha Gentol and the small band of a half-dozen elite warriors he took in tow now sought the narrow ways that would get them to the lowest gate of Mithril Hall proper. Those tunnels should be open, with the dark elves filtering out from the Undercity to clear the way. The weapons master and his escort came into the cavern that had previously served as Brunner's command post. It was deserted now, with only a few parchments and scraps from clerical preparations to show that anyone had been in the place. After the fall of the tunnels and the collapse of portions of Tunult's cavern, and many side tunnels, including the main one that led back to this chamber, Brunner's lower groups apparently had been scattered without any central command. Yutha Gentol passed through the place, hardly giving it a thought. The drow band moved swiftly down the corridors, staying generally east, silently following the weapons master's urgent lead. They came to a wide fork in the trail and noticed the very old bones of a two-headed giant lying against the wall. Ironically, a kill Brunner Battlehammer had made centuries before. Of more concern, though, was the fork in the tunnel. Frustrated at yet another delay, Yutha Gentol sent scouts left and right, then he and the rest of his group went right, the more easterly course. Yutha Gentol sighed, relieved that they had at last found the lower door, when his scout and another drow, a priestess, met him a few moments later.
"Greetings, weapons master of the second house," the priestess greeted, affording mighty Euthagentol more respect than was normally given to mere males.
"Why are you out in the tunnels?" Euthagentol wanted to know. "We are still far from the Undercity."
"Farther than you think," the priestess replied, looking disdainfully back toward the east, down the long tunnel that ended at the lower door. "The way is not clear."
Euthagentol issued a low growl. Those dark elves should have taken the Undercity by now, and should have opened the passages. He stepped by the female, his pace revealing his anger.
"You'll not break through," the priestess assured him, and he spun around, scowling as though she had slapped him in the face. "We have been striking at the door for an hour," the priestess explained, "and we shall spend another 10 days before we get past that barricade. The dwarves defend it well."
"Ultrin Sartalin!"
Euthagentol roared, his favorite title to remind the priestess of his reputation. Still, despite the fact that Euthagentol had earned that banner of supreme warrior, the female did not seem impressed.
"100 drow, 5 wizards, and 10 priestesses have not breached the door," she said evenly. "The dwarves strike back against our magic with great spears and balls of flaming pitch, and the tunnel leading to the door is narrow and filled with traps, as well defended as House Bayenri itself. 20 minotaurs went down there, and those dozen that stumbled past the traps found hearty dwarves waiting for them, coming out of concealment from small secret cubbies. 20 minotaurs were slain in the span of a few minutes."
"You'll not break through," the priestess said again, her tone matter-of-fact and in no way insulting.
"None of us will. Unless those who have entered the dwarven complex strike at the defenders of the door from behind."
Euthagentol wanted to lash out at the female, mostly because he believed her claim.
"Why would you wish to enter the complex?"
the female asked unexpectedly, slyly. Euthagentol eyed her with suspicion, wondering if she was questioning his bravery. Why wouldn't he want to find the fighting after all?
"Whispers say your intended prey is Drizzt Do'Urden," the priestess went on.
Euthagentol's expression shifted from suspicion to intrigue.
"Other whispers say the renegade is in the tunnels outside Mithril Hall," she explained, "hunting with his panther and killing quite a few drow."
Euthagentol ran a hand through his spiked hair and looked back to the west, to the wild maze of tunnels he had left behind. He felt a surge of adrenaline course through his body, a tingling that tightened his muscles and set his features in a grim lock. He knew that many groups of enemies were operating in the tunnels outside the dwarven complex, scattered bands fleeing the 7-chambered cavern where the first battle had been fought. Euthagentol and his companions had met and slain one such group of dwarves on their journey to this point. Now that he thought about it, it made sense to Euthagentol that Drizzt would be out here as well. It was very likely the renegade had been in the battle in the 7-chambered cavern, and if that was true, then why would Drizzt flee back into Mithril Hall? Drizzt was a hunter, a former patrol leader, a warrior that had survived a decade alone with his magical panther in the wild Underdark. No small feat, and one that even Euthagentol respected. Yes. Now that the priestess had told him the rumor, it made perfect sense to Euthagentol that Drizzt Do'Urden would be out there, somewhere back in the tunnels to the west, roaming and killing. The weapons master laughed loudly and started back the way he had come, offering no explanation. None was needed. To the priestess, or to Euthagentol's companions, who fell in line behind him. The weapons master of the second house was hunting.
"We are winning,"
Matron Bayenri declared. None of those around her, not Methil or Jarlaxle, not Matron Zirith Cusor Lauren of the fourth house, or Oropol Deer, matron mother of House Agric Deer, now the fifth house, not Bladen Kirst or Quenthel Bayenri, argued the blunt statement. Gandalug Battlehammer, dirty and beaten, his wrists bound tightly by slender shackles so strongly enchanted that a giant could not break them, cleared his throat, a noise that sounded positively gloating. There was more bluster than truth in the dwarf's attitude, for Gandalug carried with him a heavy weight. Even if his folk were putting up a tremendous fight, dark elves had gotten into the Undercity. And they had come to that place because of Gandalug, because of his knowledge of the secret ways. The old dwarf understood that no one could withstand the intrusions of an illithid. But the guilt remained, the notion that he, somehow, had not been strong enough. Quenthel moved before Bladenkirst could react, smacking the obstinate prisoner hard across the back, her fingernails drawing lines of blood. Gandalug snorted again, and this time Bladenkirst whacked him with her five-tongued, snake-headed whip, a blow that sent the sturdy dwarf to his knees. "Enough!" Matron Beanri growled at her daughters, a hint of her underlying frustration showing through. They all knew, and it seemed Beanri did as well, despite her proclamation, that the war was not going according to plan. Jarlaxle's scouts had informed them of the bottleneck near Mithril Hall's lowest door, and that the eastern door from the surface had been blocked soon after it was breached, at a cost of many drow lives. Quenthel's magical communications with her brother told her that the fighting was still furious on the southern and western slopes of Fourth Peak, and that the western door from the surface had not yet been approached. And Methil, who had lost his two illithid companions, had telepathically assured Matron Beanri that the fight for the Undercity was not yet won, not at all. Still, there was a measure of truth in Beanri's prediction of victory, they all knew, and her confidence was not completely superficial. The battle outside the mountain was not finished, but Bergignon had assured Quenthel that it soon would be, and given the power of the force that had gone out beside Bergignon, Quenthel had no reason to doubt his claim. Many had died in these lower tunnels, but most of the losses had been humanoid slaves, not dark elves. Now those dwarves who had been caught outside their complex after the tunnel collapse had been forced into tactics of hunt and evade, a type of warfare that surely favored the stealthy dark elves.
"All the lower tunnels will soon be secured," Matron Beanri elaborated, a statement made obvious by the simple fact that this group, which would risk no encounters, was on the move once more. The elite force surrounding Beanri was responsible for guiding and guarding the first matron mother. They would not allow Beanri any advancement unless the area in front of them was declared secure.
"The region above the ground around Mithril Hall will also be secured," Beanri added, "with both surface doors to the complex breached."
"And likely dropped," Jarlaxle dared to put in.
"Sealing the dwarves in their hole," Matron Beanri was quick to respond. "We will fight through this lower door, and our wizards and priestesses will find and open new ways into the tunnels of the complex, that we might filter among our enemies' ranks."
Jarlaxle conceded the point, as did the others. But what Beanri was talking about would take quite a bit of time, and a drawn-out siege had not been part of the plan. The prospect did not sit well with any of those around Matron Beanri, particularly the other two matron mothers. Beanri had pressured them to come out, so they had, though their houses and all the city was in a critical power flux. In exchange for the personal attendance of the matron mothers in the long march, House Thorlauren and House Agric Deer had been allowed to keep most of their soldiers at home, while the other houses, particularly the other ruling houses, had sent as much as half their complement of dark elves. For the few months that the army was expected to be away, the fourth and fifth houses seemed secure. But Xerath and Oropol had other concerns, worries of power struggle within their families. The hierarchy of any drow house, except perhaps for Beanri, was always tentative, and the two matron mothers knew that if they were away for too long, they might return to find they had been replaced. They exchanged concerned looks now, doubting expressions that ever-observant Jarlaxle did not miss. Beanri's battle group moved along on its slow and determined way, the three matron mothers floating atop their drift disks, flanked by Beanri's two daughters, dragging the dwarf, and the illithid, who seemed to glide rather than walk, his feet hidden under his long, heavy robes. A short while later, Matron Beanry informed them that they would find an appropriate cavern and set up a central throne room, from which she could direct the continuing fight. It was another indication that the war would be a long one, and again Xerath and Oropole exchanged disconcerted looks. Bladen cursed Beanry, narrowed her eyes at both of them, silently threatening. Jarlaxle caught it all, every connotation, every hint of where Matron Beanry might find her greatest troubles. The mercenary leader bowed low and excused himself, explaining that he would join up with his band and try to garner more timely information. Beanry waved her hand, dismissing him without a second thought. One of her escorts was not so casual.
"You and your mercenaries will flee,"
came an unexpected message in Jarlaxle's mind. The mercenary's own thoughts whirled in a jumble, and caught off guard, he couldn't avoid sending the telepathic reply that the notion of deserting the war had indeed crossed his mind. As close to desperation as he had ever been, Jarlaxle looked back over his shoulder at the expressionless face of the intruding Illithid.
"Beware of Beanry should she return," Methil imparted casually,
and he continued on his way with Beanry and the others. Jarlaxle paused for a long while when the group moved out of sight, scrutinizing the emphasis of the Illithid's last communication. He came to realize that Methil would not inform Beanry of his wavering loyalty. Somehow, from the way the message had been given, Jarlaxle knew that. The mercenary leaned against a stone wall, thinking hard about what his next move should be. If the Drow army stayed together, Beanry would eventually win, that much he did not doubt. The losses would be greater than anticipated, they already had been, but that would be of little concern once Mithril Hall was taken, along with all its promised riches. What then was Jarlaxle to do? The disturbing question was still bouncing around the mercenary's thoughts when he found some of his Bragandyearth lieutenants, all bearing news of the continuing bottleneck near the lower door, and information that even more Dark Elves and slaves were being killed in the outer tunnels, falling prey to roving bands of dwarves and their allies. But dwarves were defending and fighting well. Jarlaxle made his decision and relayed it silently to his lieutenants in the intricate hand code. Bragandyearth would not desert, not yet, but neither would they continue to spearhead the attack, risking their forward scouts. "Avoid all fights," Jarlaxle's fingers flashed, and the gathered soldiers nodded their accord. "We stay out of the way and we watch, nothing more."
"Until Mithril Hall is breached," one of the lieutenants reasoned back.
Jarlaxle nodded. "Or until the war becomes futile," his fingers replied, and from his expression, it was obvious the mercenary leader did not think his last words ridiculous.
Puent and his band rambled through tunnel after tunnel, growing frustrated, for they found no drow or even kobolds to slam.
"Where in the nine hells are we?"
the battle rager demanded. No answer came in reply, and when he thought about it, Puent really couldn't expect one. He knew these tunnels better than any in his troop, and if he had no idea where they were, then certainly the others were lost. That didn't bother Puent so much. He and his furious band really didn't care where they were, as long as they had something to fight. Lack of enemies was the real problem.
"Start to bangin'!"
Puent roared. And the gutbusters ran to the walls in the narrow corridor and began slamming hammers against the stone, causing such a commotion that every creature within 200 yards would easily be able to figure out where they were. Poor Bitter Dew Harple, swept up in the wake of the craziest band of suicidal dwarves, stood in the middle of the tunnel, using his glowing gem to try to sort through the few remaining parchments from his blasted spellbook, looking for a spell, any spell, though preferably one that would get him out of this place. The racket went on for several minutes, and frustrated, Puent ordered his dwarves to form up and off they stormed. They went under a natural archway, around a couple of bends in the passage, then came upon a wider and squarer way, a tunnel with worked stone along its walls and an even floor. Puent snapped his fingers, realizing that they had struck out to the west and south of Mithril Hall.
He knew this place, knew that he would find a dwarven defensive position around the next corner. He bobbed around in the lead and scrambled over a barricade that reached nearly to the ceiling, hoping to find some more allies to enlist into his terror group. As he crested the wall, Puent stopped short, his smile erased. 10 dwarves lay dead on the stone floor, amidst a pile of torn goblins and orcs. Puent fell over the wall, landed hard, but bounced right back to his feet. He shook his head as he walked among the carnage. This position was strongly fortified, with a high wall behind and a lower wall in front, where the corridor turned a sharp corner to the left. Mounted against that left-hand wall, just before the side tunnel, was a curious contraption, a deadly dwarven side-slinger catapult, with a short, strong arm that whipped around to the side, not over the top as with conventional catapults. The arm was pulled back now, ready to fire, but Puent noticed immediately that all the ammunition was gone, but the valiant dwarves had held out to the last. Puent could smell the remnants of that catapult's missiles and could see flickering shadows from the small fires. He knew before he peeked around the bend that many, many dead enemies would line the corridor beyond.
"They died well,"
the battle rager said to his minions, as they and Bitterdew crossed the back wall and walked among the bodies. The charge around the corner came fast and silent, a handful of dark elves rushing out, swords drawn. Had Bitterdew Harple not been on the alert, and had he not found the last remaining usable page of his spellbook, that would have been the swift end of the Gutbuster Brigade. But the wizard got his spell off, enacting a blinding, to the drow, globe of brilliant light. The surprised dark elves hesitated just an instant, but long enough for the Gutbusters to fall into battle posture. Suddenly it was 7 dwarves against 5 dark elves, the element of surprise gone. 7 battle ragers against 5 dark elves. And what was worse for the drow, these battle ragers happened to be standing among the bodies of dead kin. They punched, kicked, jumped, squealed, and headbutted with abandon, ignoring any hits, fighting to make their most wild leader proud. They plowed under 2 of the drow, and 1 dwarf broke free, roaring as he charged around the bend. Puent got 1 drow off to the side, caught the dark elf's swinging sword in 1 metal gauntlet, and punched straight out with the other before the drow could bring his 2nd sword to bear. The drow's head verily exploded under the weight of the spiked gauntlet, furious Puent driving his fist right through the doomed creature's skull. He hit the drow again and a 3rd time, then tossed the broken body beside the other 4 dead dark elves. Puent looked around at his freshly bloodied troops, noticed at once that 1 was missing, and noticed too that Bitterdew was trembling wildly, his jowls flapping noisily. The battle rager would have asked the wizard about it, but then the cry of agony from down the side corridor chilled the marrow in even sturdy Thibbledorf Puent's bones. He leaped to the corner and looked around. The carnage along the length of the 50-foot corridor was even more tremendous than Puent had expected. Scores of humanoids lay dead, and several small fires still burned. So thick was the pitch from the catapult missiles along the floor and walls. Puent watched as a large form entered the other end of the passage. A shadowy form, but the battle rager knew it was a dark elf, though certainly the biggest he had ever seen. The drow carried a large trident, and on the end of the trident, still wriggling in the last moments of his life, was Puent's skewered Gutbuster. Another drow came out behind the huge weapons master, but Puent hardly noticed the 2nd form, and hardly cared if 100 more were to follow. The battle rager roared in protest, but did not charge. In a rare moment where cleverness outweighed rage, Puent hopped back around the corner.
"What is it, most wild battle rager?"
3 of the Gutbusters yelled together. Puent didn't answer. He jumped into the basket of the side slinger and slashed his spiked gauntlet across the trigger rope, cutting it cleanly. Yutha Gentol Armgo had just shaken free the troublesome kill when the side slinger went off, shooting the missile Puent down the corridor. The weapons master's eyes went wide. He screamed as Puent screamed. Suddenly, Yutha Gentol wished he still had the dead dwarf handy, that he might use the body as a shield. Purely on instinct, the warrior drow did the next best thing. He grabbed his drow companion by the collar of his powafui and yanked him in front. Puent's helmet spike and half his head blasted the unfortunate dark elf, came through cleanly enough to score a hit on Yutha Gentol as well. The mighty weapons master extracted himself from the tumble as Puent tore free of the destroyed drow. They came together in a fit of fury, rage against rage, snarl against snarl, Puent scoring several hits, but Yutha Gentol, so strong and skilled, countering fiercely. The butt of the trident slammed Puent's face, and his eyes crossed. He staggered backward and realized, to his horror, that he had just given this mighty foe enough room to skewer him. A silver beast, a great wolf running on its hind legs, barreled into Yutha Gentol from the side, knocking him back to the floor. Puent shook his head vigorously, clearing his mind, and regarded the newest monster with more than a little apprehension. He glanced back up the corridor to see his gutbusters approaching fast, all of them pointing to the wolf and howling with glee.
"Bitter do,"
Puent mumbled, figuring it out. Yutha Gentol tossed the werewolf Harpal aside and leaped back to his feet. Before he had fully regained his balance, though, Puent sprang atop him. A second dwarf leaped atop him, followed by a third, a fourth, the whole of the Gutbuster Brigade. Yutha Gentol roared savagely, and suddenly the drow possessed the strength of a giant. He stood tall, dwarves hanging all over him, and he threw his arms out wide, plucking dwarves and hurling them as though they were mere rodents. Puent slammed him in the chest, a blow that would have killed a fair-sized cow. Yutha Gentol snarled and gave the battle rager a backhand slap that launched Puent a dozen feet.
"You're good,"
a shaky Puent admitted, coming up to one knee as Yutha Gentol stalked in. For the first time in his insane life, except perhaps for when he had inadvertently battled Drizzt, Thibbledorf Puent knew he was outmatched, knew that his whole brigade was outmatched, and thought he was dead. Dwarves lay around groaning, and none would be able to intercept the impossibly strong drow. Instead of trying to stand, Puent cried out and hurled himself forward, scrambling on his knees. He came up at the last second, throwing all of his weight into a right hook. Yutha Gentol caught the hand in mid-swing and fully halted Puent's momentum. The mighty drow's free hand closed over Puent's face, and Yutha Gentol began bending the poor battle rager over backward. Puent could see the snarling visage through the widespread fingers. He somehow found the strength to lash out with his free left and scored a solid hit on the drow's forearm. Yutha Gentol seemed not to care. Puent whimpered. The weapons master threw his head back suddenly. Puent thought the drow meant to issue a roar of victory, but no sound came from Yutha Gentol's mouth, no noise at all, until a moment later, when he gurgled incoherently. Puent felt the drow's grip relax, and the battle rager quickly pulled away. As he straightened, Puent came to understand. The silver werewolf had come up behind Yutha Gentol and had bitten the drow on the back of the neck. Bitter Dew held on still, all the pressure of his great maw crushing the vertebrae and the nerves. The two held the macabre pose for many heartbeats, and all the conscious gutbusters gathered around them marveled at the strength of Bitter Dew's mouth and at the fact that this tremendous drow warrior was still holding his feet. There came a loud crack, and Yutha Gentol jerked suddenly, violently. Down he fell, the wolf atop him, holding fast. Puent pointed to Bitter Dew.
"I got to get him to show me how he did that,"
the awe-stricken battle rager remarked. Bitter Dew, clamped tightly on his kill, didn't hear.
Chapter 27 The Longest Night. Belwar heard the echoes, subtle vibrations in the thick stone that no surface dweller could ever have noticed. The other 300s Verfnebli heard them as well. This was the way of the deep gnomes. In the deeper tunnels of the Underdark, they often communicated by sending quiet vibrations through the rock. They heard the echoes now, constant echoes, not like the one huge explosion they had heard a couple of hours before, the rumbling of an entire network of tunnels being dropped. The seasoned Verfnebli fighters considered the newest sound a peculiar rhythm, and they knew what it meant.
Battle had been joined, a great battle, and not so far away. Belwar conferred with his commanders many times as they inched through the unfamiliar terrain, trying to follow the strongest vibrations. Often one of the Svirfnebli on the perimeter, or at the point of the group, would tap his hammer slightly on the stone, trying to get a feel for the density of the rock. Echo hunting was tricky, because the density of the stone was never uniform, and vibrations were often distorted. Thus, the Svirfnebli, arguably the finest echo followers in all the world, found themselves more than once going the wrong way down a fork in the trail. A determined and patient bunch, though, they stayed with it, and after many frustrating minutes, a priest named Suntunovic bobbed up to Belwar and Ferbel and announced with all confidence that this was as close to the sound as these tunnels would allow them to get. The two followed the priest to the exact spot, alternating putting their ears against the stone. Indeed, the noise beyond was loud, relatively speaking. And constant, Belwar noted with some confusion, for this was not the echoing of give-and-take battle, not the echoes they had heard earlier, or at least there was more to the sound than that. Suntunovic assured the Burrow Warden this was the correct place. Mixed in with this more constant sound was the familiar rhythm of battle joined. Belwar looked to Ferbel, who nodded, then to Suntunovic. The Burrow Warden poked his finger at the spot on the wall, then backed away so Suntunovic and the other priests could crowd in. They began their chanting, a grating, rumbling, and apparently wordless sound, and every once in a while one of the priests would throw a handful of some mud-like substance against the stone. The chanting hit a crescendo. Suntunovic rushed up to the wall, his hands straight out in front of him, palms pressed tightly together. With a cry of ecstasy, the little gnome thrust his fingers straight into the stone. Then he groaned, his arm and shoulder muscles flexing as he pulled the wall apart, opened it, as though it were no more solid than a curtain of heavy fabric. The priest jumped back, and so did all the others, as the echo became a roar, and a fine spray, the mist of a waterfall, came in on them. "The surface it is," Ferbel muttered, barely able to find his breath. And so it was. But this deluge of water was nothing like any of the gnomes had pictured the surface world, was nothing like the descriptions in the many tales they had heard of the strange place. Many in the group harbored thoughts of turning back then and there, but Belwar, who had spoken with Drizzt not so long ago, knew something here was out of the ordinary. The Burrow Warden hooked a rope from his belt with his pickaxe hand and held it out to Ferbel, indicating that the counselor should tie it around his waist. Ferbel did so and took up the other end, bracing himself securely. With only the slightest of hesitation, the brave Belwar squeezed through the wall, through the veil of mist. He found the waterfall and a ledge that led him around it, and Belwar gazed upon the stars. Thousands of stars! The gnome's heart soared. He was awed and frightened all at once. This was the surface world, that greatest of caverns, under a dome that could not be reached. The moment of pondering, of awe, was short-lived, defeated by the clear sounds of battle. Belwar was not in Keeper's Dale, but he could see the light of the fight, flames from torches and magical enchantments, and he could hear the ring of metal against metal and the familiar screams of the dying. With Belwar in their lead, the 300 Svirfnebli filtered out of the caverns and began a quiet march to the east. They came upon many areas that seemed impassable, but a friendly elemental, summoned by gnomish priests, opened the way. In but a few minutes the battle was in sight, the scramble within the misty veil of armor-clad horsemen and lizard-riding drow, of wretched goblins and kobolds and huge humans more than twice the height of the tallest Svirfneblin. Now Belwar did hesitate, realizing fully that his force of 300 would plunge into a battle of thousands, a battle in which the gnomes had no way of discerning who was winning.
"It is why we have come," Ferbel whispered into the Burrow Warden's ear.
Belwar looked hard at his uncharacteristically brave companion.
"For Blindenstone,"
Ferbel said. Belwar led the way. Drizzt held his breath. They all did, and even Guinevar was wise enough to stifle an instinctive snarl. The five companions huddled on a narrow ledge in a high, wide corridor, while a column of drow, many drow, marched past, a line that went on and seemed as if it would never end. 2,000? Drizzt wondered. 5,000? He had no way of guessing. There were too many, and he couldn't rightly stick his head out and begin a count. What Drizzt did understand was that the bulk of the drow force had linked together and was marching with a singular purpose. That could